Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Thursday, March 21st, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we're going to have a spoiler-filled conversation about Doug Liman's new film, Roadhouse. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film staff writer and box office analyst, Ryan Scott.
Hey, hey, everyone. How's it going?
All right, Ryan, I know you had a chance to see this new Roadhouse movie at South by Southwest, so we'll talk about that in just a minute. But before we get into that, what is your relationship to the original Roadhouse? Was that a movie that you like grew up watching? Was it in your rotation a lot? Where do you stand on that one?
So real quick before that, I have to apologize to the audience. I'm dealing with some pretty severe allergy stuff right now, so my voice is pretty shot. So that's why I sound like a raspy old man, but... anyway, aside from that, Roadhouse is a movie that I actually had almost no relationship with up until a handful of years ago, because it was a blank spot that I realized that I needed to fill in. So I watched it, and I enjoyed it for what it was. It plays a little campy, for a modern audience, I think, but, Patrick Swayze is such a singular movie star. That's one of the things that I think sticks out to me in watching that movie. Because like he does bring something to it that like where that movie could have just been such a lousy, forgettable thing, but like all Swayze. So I don't have like a huge relationship to it, but I do think it's one of those movies that like demonstrates like what we lost when Swayze left this best of all worlds.
Yes. I think I saw this movie one time when I was a kid or a teenager or something, and then I kind of forgot about it. And I just rewatched it for the first time in maybe 20 years or 15 years or something, like a couple weeks ago, in preparation for this new film. And I had totally forgotten just absolutely like how bonkers this movie is. It's so nuts, the original film, that, you know, a Hollywood studio was like, yes, take millions of dollars and go make this. Like, it is just so deranged. It's so niche and so specific, and I just can't believe that it exists as a movie. This Swayze factor.
It just says so much about that time. It really does.
Yes, yeah. The Swayze factor is like, as you say, off the charts. I mean, he really, I think, elevates that movie to something pretty special, if not, yeah, as you mentioned, like a little weird for modern audiences to watch. So tell me about your general thoughts, I guess, before we get into super spoilery stuff about the new film starring Jake Gyllenhaal.
So I think, as I have jokingly described myself on this podcast several times, I am a popcorn eating rube. I am not your art house junkie per se. I love blockbusters. I value movies as entertainment. I think taking all of that into account and sort of, I feel, having very reasonable expectations for what this movie was going to be, I ended up falling on the side of really, really having a great time with it. I thought it was a blast. I will say there is something about seeing something like this at a film festival. Most people are going to be watching this in their living room by themselves, probably. The energy at South by Southwest at a big premiere like that can color an experience for sure. That having been said, a lot of my fellow film journalist folk did not love this movie. I believe our own Jacob Hall didn't come down on the side of liking it very much. So even with that experience, I seem to have a bit of a different take than a lot of my peers. But I had a blast with it, and I'll probably watch it again once it hits Prime. I really enjoyed it.
Okay. I thought this movie was okay. I thought it was much better than I anticipated it being. I kind of, I don't know, Doug Liman is like one of those directors that there are so many stories about the making of his movies where they just get super chaotic, and it feels like every movie is like inches away from pure disaster for him. And sometimes he's able to pull it out and, you know, in the editing or in post or whatever, and like turn in what I would argue is like an action movie masterpiece, like Edge of Tomorrow. And then other times the things just kind of get away from him a little bit. And so I don't know, leading into this one, there was so much sort of fracas and brouhaha around it that I was like, oh no, is this going to be one of those like Doug Liman movies that like everybody would just rather forget? But I ended up having fun with it. And I don't know, man, it's a weird one for me. Like I'm not like, I think Jacob like actively hates this movie, and it sounds like you really enjoyed it. And I find myself like somewhere in the middle. Like I mostly enjoyed it. So
sure, but I also think that like I'm taking it for what it is, right? Like I don't think that I did not wander into a 2024 Roadhouse remake directed by Doug Liman expecting anything other than a beat 'em up popcorn movie. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, and I think that's what we got. And I think like it's entertaining. Like, and it's not. It's not anything more than that.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's my thing. Like, that's sort of where, like, you know, I enjoyed it on its own terms, for sure.
Yeah, I agree with you in that, like, it, and I think Jacob said this the other day, you know, it just, it's not really a movie that's really, like, about anything bigger. It definitely, like, has its sights set pretty low and just tries to, like, accomplish what it tries to accomplish and not, like, bite off more than it can chew or anything. But, like, even with that, though, Ryan, there's something about the 80s setting of the original and the fact that that movie appears to be, I don't want to like cast aspersions, but appears to be the end result of simply colossal amounts of cocaine being taken, that like places that film in this kind of heightened world. And like, I don't know if you remember the details, Ryan, but like the villain talks about bringing JCPenney to the small town where the action is set. And like Swayze's character Dalton is not a bouncer, but a so-called cooler who is so good at his incredibly specific job that like people know him by name across the entire country. Like stories of this man have swept the land, you know? So there's
But that's the Swayze factor, right? You only believe that because it's Swayze. Like it doesn't work if it's like, I'm trying to think who was maybe coming up in that era, but you know what I mean? It's like, you have to have such a movie star to take that on and be like, yeah, I totally buy that. Like that works for me. And yeah, it does sort of work in that movie. It works in like the late 80s sort of like just era. Like it doesn't work now, but it worked then.
Yeah, I'm trying to like put my finger on what it is about that era and like the movies of that era. But like there's an inherent ridiculousness and kind of that goofy charm to that first movie. And in contrast, this new movie does this thing that like almost every modern Hollywood remake or reimagining does, which is try to treat the subject matter with this sort of gritty, somewhat realistic approach. So like the biggest example I can think of is in the first movie, Patrick Swayze's character is just really good at fighting. That's kind of like his thing. They never really explain it too much. In this version, Jake Gyllenhaal
kicks ass.
Yeah. In this version, Jake Gyllenhaal's character is a former UFC fighter instead of just being, you know, a cooler. And so that might explain why he's so good at fighting, but by grounding the movie like that and sort of applying that approach to the way that they tell this story this time, it kind of takes the movie out of that 80s fantasy kind of thing, that subtle insular fantasy world, that heightened world. And it makes me think about these characters as real people a little bit, which kind of makes this thing a kind of depressing and somewhat sad experience a little bit. It kind of casts a shadow over all of the action here, because when the movie asks you to take it somewhat seriously, the fights and stuff, because they basically become almost too real, you know, like, because then you're putting yourself in the headspace of these characters and you're forced to like contend with what is driving them to do these things. Whereas in the original movie, you're able to sort of, it's able to like keep the audience at arm's length a little bit, keep our heads out of those, the characters' heads, and kind of just more focus on the vibes a little bit, if that makes sense.
Well, because the original was very much like your 80s bad guys, right? Like they're just bad guys, and you're rooting for Patrick Swayze because he's the good guy. He's a little complicated, but he's the good guy. This movie definitely, like, the bad guys are really bad. But like Jake Gyllenhaal's Dalton, I don't know how much we want to get into spoilers here, but like,
yeah, full spoilers. Let's do it.
He has some pretty dark motivations here. Like you find out that he killed a guy in the ring that was kind of his friend, and like, and that sort of ended his MMA career. And so like, yeah, a lot of these fights do take on like a weight in reality, but I think through a modern lens, I appreciate on some level that take, right? Like that, like, okay, you want to put some weight there. Like it's a remake in the loosest sense too. Like it really doesn't take a lot of it takes a couple of character names. It takes the rough premise of like a strong guy is defending a seaside bar from assholes. Like, but like everything else is pretty different. Yeah. And so, you know, I, yeah, definitely you're right. Like this movie exists in a form of reality. Like, it's not quite our reality, but it's one that's very close to it. Mm-hmm. The original Roadhouse does not quite exist in our reality. Like, the original Roadhouse exists in the exact same universe that the Fast and Furious movies exist in. Like, those movies exist in the same universe to me. Like, that's the universe that, like, Patrick Swayze's Dalton exists in.
That's ironic, because at the very end of this movie, it almost feels like this film kind of turns into a Fast and Furious movie for a second. Like, there's that moment where, like, the two boats are, like, ramping at each other, and, like, Dalton jumps off and grabs onto the other one. I was like, wow, this is a very Vin Diesel moment right here.
You know? But, like, when I say form of our reality, I mean, like, those boats crashing into each other, that's the craziest thing that's ever happened in that world.
Yes.
Right? Like, whereas, that's, like, a Tuesday afternoon for a Fast and Furious movie. So so I think that's what I'm getting at. It's like where the bumper sort of ends, you know, like where, like, if Swayze had still been alive, like, I could totally have seen him in a Fast and Furious movie, like maybe even just playing an older version of Dalton. Like, it, yeah, you know, he would have fit into that world very well.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Because especially, like, in the first movie, there's that scene where the bad guys take a monster truck and just drive it through a car dealership for basically no reason, like just to sort of flex and, like, show their power.
Well, you see, Ben, it's because they had the budget for a monster truck. And I don't know, it is difficult to absorb 80s pop culture sometimes for me. As a, like, I say this a lot when I look at, like, sometimes, like, you'll see, like, you'll hear music from the 80s or you'll see something, and it is hard for me to imagine sometimes that people enjoyed these things unironically. Like, you know what I mean? Like, there's this thing where it's like, wow, no, people just liked this. Like, people just liked Skid Row, you know, and people, like, just watched Roadhouse and were like, in its theatrical run, and we're like, oh my God, have you seen this new movie Roadhouse? And, like, and there was no irony. Like, and so that's, I think, fascinating to me. It's like, cause we'll watch it now and it does feel like almost ironic, cause it is so insane. There is just a monster truck there. Why is that there? I don't know. Cause they had the budget and somebody had a lot of cocaine that day. Like, it's just like, that's that it is worlds apart.
Yeah. So I guess, like, when I'm thinking about the old movie and comparing it to the new movie, and I try to take everything, you know, on their own terms. But it's hard when, you know, this is like a reimagining of the original. So of course I'm going to be thinking about the original the whole time. But, like, you know, Swayze had that natural charisma that we were talking about, even when he has to, like, rip a man's throat out, which is up there among the most insane things to ever happen in, like, 1980s action.
I think any action movie ever, any relatively mainstream action movie, that is still up there as far as, like, oh, wow, he, like, literally ripped a guy's throat out. That's the climax of that movie.
Yeah, and so in this movie, like, near the end, when Gyllenhaal's version of Dalton gets pissed off, like, he's nearly driven out of the town. I know we're jumping all over the place in the plot. We're not going to go through it, like, beat by beat or anything. But he's, like, basically driven out of town, or, like, on his way out. And Ben Brandt, the bad guys, his goons, have set the local bookstore on fire. And that is, like, what is it called? The straw that broke the camel's
back. Breaks the camel's back.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's like a switch gets flipped in his head, where he goes from being, you know, ostensibly the good guy, basically to, like, a psychopath where he just starts killing people. And I know that Swayze kills people at the end of the original movie, but because I think we've seen Jake Gyllenhaal play characters like the guy he plays in, like, Nightcrawler, for example, who is, like, you know, really dialed up and, like, on the edge and, like, a sociopath or a full-on psychopath or something, the whole movie kind of takes this really, it takes on, like, a much darker tone in this one than we ever got in the first movie. So it absolutely
embraces that, for sure. Like, it embraces that turn. Like, it embrace, and I do think that's probably why you cast a guy like Gyllenhaal, because I don't know. Let's say you cast Chris Pratt, like, you don't buy that term.
The darkness to it. Yeah.
There's that point at the end where he visits the guys and he just kills that guy and, like, drops him in the pool right away.
Yeah.
And that's where the switch flips. I believe that with Jake Gyllenhaal, 100%. I don't question it. Like, I believe that guy's there. Like, I think that's why, like, his Mysterio works in Spider-Man Far From Home. And I think that, like, you know, some of his better performances are anchored to that sort of dichotomy. And
yeah,
I think
even
that,
going back to, like, Donnie Darko, right?
I was going to bring that up 100%. So, like, which also starred Patrick Swayze. So I think that's why you cast Jake Gyllenhaal in this, and that's why it works. Like, I think that's, or at least, like, if it works for you as a viewer, it works because Gyllenhaal can commit to both of those things very well, I think. Like, because I also buy him in the early parts of the movie where he's just like this sort of like sad, aimless drifter, but then he's like charmed by the town and the bookstore, and you know, like he's kind of quiet, but like people like him, and I don't know, like I buy that guy, but then I buy like he finds a little bit of peace in this like kind of chaotic place, and then when that really gets ripped out from under him, he just loses it. Like I, for as much as you can say about the movie, I think that for what this movie was asking him to do, Gyllenhaal was very well cast.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, let's take a break and then we'll come back and continue talking about this movie. All right, so are there any favorite scenes that you wanted to highlight, Ryan? I have at least one that I wanted to mention, but what were some good moments that jumped out at you?
You know, I really sort of like the beginning of the movie. Like, I like that initial post-Malone fight, and I like the way they sort of set up Dalton's character of, like, he gets in the ring, and, like, the guy's like, I won't even, like, he just doesn't even want to fight, and then, like, you know, the whole parking lot thing of, like, him getting stabbed and the money. Like, I really liked the character introduction and like your way into it, because they also, I like that they didn't like bathe the whole thing in exposition. Like, it's a 5-minute scene before you're like, okay, he's at the Roadhouse. Like, I really did sort of like that entree into it.
Yeah.
I think that like set me up well to be like, okay, I'm into this.
Yeah, I think I think it was my favorite scene in the whole movie. And I think Jacob mentioned this too, when he was talking briefly about it on a previous episode of the show. But it comes pretty early on in the film. And it's that basically what I'll call the slap fight in the parking lot once he gets to the Roadhouse.
Oh, yeah.
Which is just like a really, really entertaining, like well choreographed moment. And like the idea that he drives these guys to the hospital afterwards is great.
Yeah,
and then
that's the funniest moment in the movie for sure.
Yeah.
Like that's one of those moments that, because I know, I guess we don't want to talk about it too much, but Doug Liman really wanted a theatrical release for this movie. And seeing that scene in a theater full of people, you're like, I see why. Like,
yeah.
I see, you know, because, and shout out to, the actor's name is Arturo Castro, I think.
Yes.
He plays Mo, and his whole, like, the way, because he's like that way for the rest of the movie, but that scene specifically, he's so great.
Yes.
Like, he is such a good comic foil for Dalton in that moment. Yeah, like he's kind of the like quiet MVP of this movie.
Yeah, 100%. I know him from his work on Broad City, and he's like, for people who don't recognize him by name, he's like the guy who's like the timid kind of guy in Brandt's gang, and his joke ratio in this movie is just like off the charts. So that whole thing really worked.
He comes out Doug Liman did him a lot of favors, because like every single time he's on screen and every line he gets, like he doesn't have a ton of screen time, but like he crushes. Like, it's like the Bill Murray in Caddyshack thing where like you remember every scene. Like, Bill Murray's not in Caddyshack a ton, but like he, you know, you remember every scene he's in. And that, I think, I'm not saying it's quite that level, but I think it's that idea.
Yeah.
And then Billy Magnuson as well gets a lot of like, you know, I think he chews up scenery pretty fun. But yeah, that scene is awesome.
Yeah, that's great stuff. I kind of feel like the movie never really gets to that same tone again, because it's still like relatively light at that point, and then it just kind of gets a little darker as like the real understanding of what this gang is trying to do takes in, and then in the introduction of Conor McGregor, like, you know, it just ratchets up the intensity to a level where like a slap fight just isn't going to cut it anymore, you know, as the movie kind of escalates. So
yeah, and Conor McGregor is so chaotic, like his character is so like lawless evil, that like you can't really get back to that. Like, he's so that's really what it is. And
what do you think about him, about Conor McGregor in this movie?
I can't take credit for this, but Eric Vespi, who I believe listeners should probably know, he worked for Slash Film for a long time, a co-host of the KingCast, he talked about how McGregor sort of had like this early Schwarzenegger thing going on, where it's like the English like and line delivery skills aren't really there, but there's so much swagger that it almost sort of works. Like, it'd be hard to accuse him of being a great actor, but it does work for, I think, what the movie's asking him to do. You know, cause there aren't a ton of guys I think right now that could, you know, unless you cast maybe like Alan Ritchson, or I'm trying to think who else maybe could, you know, but I get why you put him in there, like, especially because he was a real MMA fighter. So like, I think it worked for I like the thing I said, because Jacob was pretty not keen on McGregor's performance, and I'm like, I would watch him in another movie if he's like a Bond style like secondary villain where he doesn't have a lot of lines, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like I could see him having a place, because there is, the dude's got charisma. Like, I mean, I don't know again if it works super well like as a straight up actor, but I understand why he's in this movie. Like it's not. The casting seems less stunty to me after having seen it. Like, I do get it.
Yeah, yeah. I'm in the same boat, and I feel like I would not be surprised at all if he is leading, you know, direct-to-video action movies or something in a year or two. Like, it just does not seem like...
Or using that to, like, build into, like, entering another franchise in a smaller role or something. I would like to say Billy Magnussen really is good in this movie. He's a lot of fun. He's kind of the main villain. And there's that scene where he's trying to get the shave on the boat and like the guy like keeps, that's where I think like Billy's just having an absolutely wonderful time in this movie. And I think he's at his best when like in Game Night as well, like Billy Magnussen gets to sort of, so I think that, I think if this movie did anything well, it definitely casted well. Like, because even you have, like, Jessica Williams, who plays Frankie, like, the bar owner. She's very good. I don't know her name, but whoever plays the daughter at the bookstore is so charming that, like, when that all goes bad later, like, you sort of understand why Jake Gyllenhaal goes absolute apeshit.
Yeah, I think the problem that I don't have a problem with that actor. I just have a problem with that character as written, because that, like, nothing about the relationship and the interaction between Dalton and that girl struck me as, like, genuine or honest in the same way that even, you know, interactions between other characters in this movie did. Like, not that it had to be... you know, far and away the most natural thing or whatever, but it stood out to me as being like incredibly forced and awkward from a script perspective, because, like, you know, he gets off the bus and instantly she strikes up this conversation with him, and she gives him this book about the tree, and like if he had walked inside their bookstore to ask for directions or like something, done anything, and then their interaction could have gotten off on a more natural foot, I think I would have not even given it a second thought. But it just feels like the script jumping out of the screen at me and like flipping pages, and like you can see the screenwriter like pointing at lines and being like, hey, we need to get from here to here, we need to set this up for later, so like can we just go ahead and do all that, you know. It just becomes, it's like you're seeing through the code of the Matrix or something when something
this,
like that
happens. this is where you're better at this job than I am. Like, this is where, like, my analytical mind is very surface level. And, like, so this is a great example. Like, I've said that a lot in this podcast. Excellent example of what I mean when I say that. Where, like, I did not pick up on that at all. Like, I now that you've said it, I'm like, yeah, that's kind of, okay, that makes a lot of sense. But I'm like, man, does my brain just allow me to, like, watch a movie? So yeah, I don't know. People have asked me like, "Oh, would you like to make a movie or do something?" I'm like, I don't think I have that ability in me, and that's exactly why. But yeah, no, that's a good point. You're right. Like, I wouldn't have thought of that until you said it. But it is definitely doing that for sure. But I still buy it. Like, I still buy like him. He's so, because like when you meet him, he's so down. Like, he's so just like, he's sleeping in his car, getting kicked.
Yeah, he's
out
like
of
a lost puppy or something.
Yeah, I was actually convinced, because like he was making a fair amount of money from these fights, and he was tucking it away. And I was pretty convinced he was like, we were going to get some reveal that he was like saving money for something.
Mm-hmm.
Like, but then we never really got there. Like, later, obviously, gives money to help, you know, the bookstore people out. But like, that's money he got sort of in that bad deal. So I don't know. There were little threads like that that I felt like were tugged on, but never really fully satisfied. But I don't know. Again, we're talking about a Roadhouse remake here. Like, if you're willing, I guess all I would say is like to your average viewer, like if you're listening to this, maybe you haven't watched it yet. Like, we haven't spoiled enough that I would say like, don't watch it. But I think that like, if a Roadhouse remake is remotely appealing to you, like if you watched that trailer and thought like, this seems interesting to me, I do believe in my heart of hearts that your average viewer is going to come out on the side of like enjoying this. That's what I believe. Like,
yeah, I think so too.
I think it was made for like broad audiences in mind. And I think Doug Liman is pretty good at that sort of thing. I agree with you that like his stuff is pretty chaotic and sometimes that shows, but it still can come out as pretty fun. And
yeah,
I do see, like, now if that, now I don't know what's true, what's not true. Supposedly Lyman and Gyllenhaal took more money for it to go to streaming, but I do understand, having seen it the way that I seen it, why he fought so hard to get it in a theater. Like, it, I do think this is a movie that could have stood to make some money, for whatever that's worth. And I think it's going to do well on Prime Video. Like, I think people are going to enjoy it. I don't know. It's not like something where, like, I think, like, I watch it, I'm like, oh, I see why Amazon's like dumping this to streaming. It doesn't smell like that to me at all. It actually smells as like a pretty fun time for most people to make.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned Jessica Williams. And before I forget, I just wanted to mention, I kind of felt like there was a longer version of this movie that had more of her character in it or something. Like, that there was something that just feels a little, I don't know, like unfinished or a little slightly awkward or something about her character. Cause like, and some of her motivations and stuff, there, the camera lingers in a couple different moments on her in ways where it kind of led me to believe, like, oh, am I supposed to be thinking that she's like working with Billy Magnuson's character and she's in on this whole thing? And then like, she runs out to meet him in the car at one point, and like, she kind of like is out of the bar for a little while and then just like comes back in later. And it's just kind of, I don't know, at the end of the movie, I was kind of thinking back in my head about her character and her arc and like what we knew about her when and all of that. And I was just like, huh, I don't really know if that adds up to everything that that character could have been. So I wonder if there's something, you know, sort of left on the cutting room floor with her that would,
I have no doubt in my mind, because the script, you can feel like there's a lot of threads. And I think that they probably, like, in the editing room had to figure out, like, which ones do we actually follow and which ones do we, you know, it does feel like there might be like a 2.5 hour cut of this movie somewhere that like is almost too much.
Yeah.
Like, cause you're right. Yeah. I think you're right. But I also think that like they, at some point you have to make choices. Like, once you get down there and like, you can't, like, this movie can't be 2.5 hours long. You know what I mean? Like, it's just not that kind of movie. So I think that at some point they had to, cause I also feel like there might've been a little more room for Post Malone's character, like,
yeah,
other than that open, than that first scene. Like, I feel like maybe you get him for a reason other than, but I don't know. Like, I'm just like, I regardless of all of that, I still come out on the side of like being wildly entertained by the whole thing, even if it's like imperfect, and few things are perfect, so whatever.
Yeah, the Post Malone thing, I was wondering if he might like come back at the end, because he has such a small role in it and
right,
like barely shows up in the beginning, and for him to come back at the end would kind of sort of be like what happens with Sam Elliott's character in the original movie, who is like, first of all, I can't believe that when I talked about rewatching this movie, I forgot to mention Sam Elliott, because like, holy hell, this is like the hottest man who has ever lived, this character that he plays in the first movie. He, like, my wife was watching this and she was like, Jesus Christ, like, she, you know, we were sitting on the couch watching it and I was like, yeah, I know what you mean, like, this guy has got it, like, you know,
it's BDE, the hair,
whatever
it's
you want to call it, oh,
crazy,
yeah,
feathery hair that he has, that's just, yeah, like, but yeah, like, there are some of those people that show up on screen in certain movies and you're like, and while you're watching, you're convinced, like, is that the most attractive a person has ever been? And like, yeah, and yeah, like, even though he looks ripped straight from the 80s, like, he's got those scenes. I don't even remember too much, but like, there are those scenes with Sam Elliott, like, and he's just got like his shirt open and like, there's just the taco meat chest hair there.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, oh, yeah. And he just, yeah, looks like he's been sunburnt for 20 years.
Yep. My dude's, yeah, got it going on for sure. So yeah, he plays Dalton's mentor, like his, you know, another cooler in the industry who's known the world over, apparently. And he like comes in at the end of the movie and like ends up sort of fighting on Dalton's side and like, basically helping him out in this sort of small town Western scenario that he's got himself into. So I was wondering if the Post Malone character might, you know, not that he was a mentor to Jake Gyllenhaal, but like might serve some of that plot function where he could come in and like help resolve some of these brawls or some of these big battles or whatever.
Yeah, like he maybe like when things went south, there was a version of it where like Dalton like called some folks that he knew, because like he even made jokes about that like earlier in the movie where he was like, you should have hired the other guy or whatever.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
I think that maybe like then he hires the other guy or whatever later, like,
yeah,
you know, it ends up being a brawl. Yeah, I mean, that maybe there was a version of it that was that way, because it was interesting to me that, like, Post Malone is a very famous guy. Like, it's interesting that he was in it for such a short period of time.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think, yeah, he was fun for his bit of it. Like, I,
yeah,
I, he's a guy that I've seen in a couple things now where he's been in it for like a few minutes, and I, I would like to see him get a slightly bigger role in something. Like, I would like to see, can he really do it? Because I'm actually curious with him. Where I'm like, that's my one of my takeaways. I'm like, I would watch him do the right thing. Like, if the Safdie brothers did something, and I could see him having, like, a slightly meatier role and actually, like, enjoying that in the right context.
Yeah, for sure. I thought Daniela Melchior did exactly what the script asked her to do. Like, you know, she was charming enough, and their relationship she had with Dalton was fine. Like, nothing really to write home about, but it certainly seemed, like, more... I don't know, realistic and natural than the relationship that Swayze has with the female lead in the original Roadhouse. So I'll say that. And then I guess the last thing that I wanted to talk to you about before we start wrapping things up here is, like, what did you think about the fights in this movie? Aside from that opening slap fight that we talked about, what did you think about, like, the way that the brawls were actually filmed here?
So a lot of people I've seen complain about this, like, and so I'll say this. I wrote a story for us before I saw the movie about how the fights were filmed. So I sort of knew what they did. I don't think it would have stood out to me in any negative way had I not known that. Like, I could see what they did having known how they did it. So I was kind of looking for it. They did it in this very interesting way, like where they're stitching several takes together to... I thought... If I remove that element from my brain, I think it looks good. But like, but the thing is, a lot of people, it's very digital, right? Like, because they're stitching several takes together. But I think, like, to the average viewer, what it's accomplishing, I get what they're trying to do. So yeah, I mean, it's hard for me to sort of even remove myself from that, because your average viewer isn't going to know what I knew, right? Like not everyone's going to go that deep on how they film the fights. So like, armed with that knowledge, it colors it for sure. But yeah, it gives it a look. It gives it a very specific look.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I thought most of it looked terrible, to be honest with you.
Like, yeah, look, I don't know if I would go so far as say terrible, but it definitely has a look to it. You know, so like yeah, I don't know what else to say about it other than, like, it's not like I've seen better fight choreography in movies, like the Raid movies or like John Wick or some of these movies where, like, so it's not that, but also I don't think this movie would have lent itself to that style necessarily. So, like, you know, I get what they were doing.
I kind of think it would have lent itself to it just because, like, that's what you're paying for kind of to see in a movie like this, is these hand-to-hand fights. And, like, the way that it exists now is the camera kind of goes, I have not read your article yet, and I'm going to link to that in the show notes to find out more. And I haven't actually read it yet either. So I'm going to check this out as soon as we're done recording. But, like, the camera seems to go into this kind of, like, fight mode, which is, like, it appears to consist of, like, a GoPro or, like, a slight fisheye type lens combined with what seems to be, like, maybe digital doubles of the actors being thrown around and defying physics, not really in a fun way, but in a way that kind of looks just off enough where your eye recognizes that what you're seeing is not actually real, you know? So instead of, like, relying on solid choreography and, like, trusting the stunt performers to do their jobs, or, like, the lead actors to be able to actually learn the moves that they need to well enough to be able to, like, sell the visceral nature of these fights, the movie kind of chickens out, I thought, by, like, relying on that CG approach, and that it just kind of bummed me out, because this is Doug Liman we're talking about. Like, he directed The Bourne Identity. He knows how to stage great hand-to-hand fight scenes. So I was just kind of disappointed with that stuff.
Yeah, I think it'll make sense to you once you read. I don't want to sort of butcher, because it is actually kind of a complicated process, but it's essentially like a three-step process of, like, filming, like, a version of the fights with the stunt performers, and then you have, like, the actual actor, like, filming a scene where they're actually punching, like, a red bag so they can get the whole punch in, mm-hmm. and then you have, like, a take of the other actor, like, actually taking a punch, but, like, with, like, a pad, and then they'll go in and, like, combine all the takes and, like, digitally remove the pad so it looks like the idea is that it's supposed to look like the actual actor is taking a punch, and, like, it all sort of, you know, it's an interesting approach. I didn't know how it was all going to look, but, you know, that is very roughly what it, I would encourage you to sort of look at what the stunt choreographer actually said about it, because I'm, butchering it, but that's more or less what it is.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's good to know that it was like an active decision that they made instead of like a budgetary restriction or something, because that's what I was thinking. I was like, man, did they just like run out of money?
And it was a style choice. Okay. And it actually seems like expensive to do it the way they did it, if I'm being honest. So I definitely don't think it was a money thing.
Well, yeah, that just did not work for me. But I would love to know from our listeners if that worked for you, if you noticed any of the sort of choppiness that I picked up on there, or if it was just like, yeah, you were expecting, you know, what do you expect? It's a Roadhouse remake type of thing. So I'm trying to think if there's anything else that I wanted to mention here, Ryan. Okay. Last question. Do you want to see a sequel? Because at the very end... Okay, let me finish. You've spoiled your own answer here. So at the very end of the movie, Conor McGregor and Jake Gyllenhaal have this like knockdown, drag out, epic fight inside the Roadhouse, the titular Roadhouse, and it's like a friggin' Blade movie or something where people are getting stabbed with wooden stakes all over their bodies or whatever, and it kind of seems like Conor McGregor's character is dead at one point, but then at the very end of the movie, like as the credits are rolling, I guess it's like a mid-credit scene or something, you see him like stalking his way out of a hospital, like he survived and he's walking out the doors wearing a hospital gown. So it kind of seems like they could be setting up for some sort of sequel. I wouldn't be surprised, honestly, if this movie does like gangbusters numbers for Prime Video, if they just went ahead and did it. I don't know if they would do it with Doug Liman, because as we've said, he's kind of like a whirlwind of a filmmaker, let's put it like that. But I wouldn't be surprised to see them greenlight a sequel. And yeah, my question to you was, do you want to see it? So now that I know the answer is no, why would you not be interested in that?
It's just one of those things. Not everything needs a sequel, right? Like, and it doesn't, the story was resolved. Like, I think the McGregor stinger, my read on that was just like a little bit of a fun note for that character, not like really trying to set anything up.
Okay. I hope you're right. I hope that's all it was.
That was my read on it, where it was almost more of like an 80s, 90s credit scene in that sense, like the Ferris Bueller credit scene, right? Like, it's not trying to set up like the Roadhouse universe. It's just,
it's just a
thing. This movie, I had a fun time with it. I actually kind of really liked the note that it left off with Gyllenhaal's Dalton. Like, I sort of liked that, like, yeah, hey, look, it's just over for me now. I'm going to ride off into the sunset, sort of, and that's it for me. And, like, I think, like, the continuing adventures of Dalton would be, like, really disingenuous. And, like, I don't need to see, like, the 80s Incredible Hulk TV series version of, like, Dalton's adventures across America or whatever. Like, he's got like this beast inside of him. That's like the whole, like, I don't need, like, I'm a little upset that I just pitched what that would actually be, but like, I don't need that. I had fun with this. I'd rather see, like, if you told me Jake Gyllenhaal and Doug Liman were doing another movie together, I'd be like, okay, like, I would totally check that out. But I don't need a sequel to this. This is fine as it is.
Okay. Yeah, you and I are definitely in full agreement there. Okay. Well, I think that's going to do it for today's episode. I'm going to try to link to Ryan's article. I'm sure we have a Jacob's review from South by Southwest that I'll link to as well. Maybe a couple other Roadhouse related articles up at slashfilm.com. So check that out. And as always, go to slashfilm.com for a bunch of movie and TV related stuff. Slashfilm Daily is published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Please take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That would really help us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thank you so much for listening, and we will talk to you tomorrow.